The sandpaper provided on the yellow Swan Vesta box is golden, and nothing else scratches like it. I pull the match towards me. I know that one is supposed to strike away in case fragments of burning matchhead fly into the face, but I prefer the scooping inwards motion, the way one finishes by bringing the flaring match up before one's eyes. The sulphurous incense tingles in my nostrils as I tip the lit match at an angle over the bowl and then slowly flatten it out. Each inhalation sucks the flame downwards over the prepared tobacco, which fizzes and bubbles in welcome, its moist freshness imparting a thick sweetness to the smoke. Finally, when the whole surface area is lit and just before my fingers burn, three flicks of the wrist extinguish the match. It tinkles as it hits the glass of the ashtray. Matches charred almost to the end have always been a revealing clue for Columbos and Sherlocks. A pipe smoker did this deed, Watson. You mark my words. I am puffing now. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 draws on the pipe, smacking the lips at the side of the mouth. Each hard suck stokes up the boiler, so that on the 6th or 7th pull I can breathe in a whole lungful. The hot smoke instantly penetrates the bronchioles and alveoli of the lungs, sending its gift of nicotine rushing through the blood to the brain. So powerful a hit can cause giddiness and sweating in even the most hardened pipe smoker. But the bang deep inside, the grateful surge of encephalins and endorphins, the thudding kick to the system, followed by the sweet electric buzz and hum as the body's benign pharmacopoeia is released in a single torrent. What a coughs, nausea, burns to the tongue and mouth, bitter tar in the spittle, and the slow degradation of pulmonary capacity compared to that spinning, pulsing burst of love, that shuddering explosion of joy. That first dose is really what the experience is all about. From then on, the trick is to keep the pipe alight with gentle, infrequent tuts and puffs on the stem. Smaller, cigarette-sized inhalations of smoke will follow until the remaining plug, which has acted as a filter for the tobacco above it, is so fouled and contaminated with tar and toxins that the pipe may be declared dead and ready for the cleaning, scraping and reaming routine to be undertaken all over again. I am at the steady puffing stage now, as content as any human on the planet, a self-fulfilling contentment that only a pipe can provide. Pipe smokers look content, they know themselves to be a symbol of old-fashioned contentment, and therefore they are content. When a loud skittering above my head jerks me up from the exercise book I am marking, damn it to hell! It was just one little noise, like a mouse in the wainscoting. I can ignore it. But no, another sound, that unmistakable thud made by bare feet on floorboards. A wrathful tide engulfs me. I am now precisely as irate as I was content. Had I been less placidly pipe-smokingly serene, I would not now be streaking up the stairs with such fury. Phillips! Of course! Who else? Right. Well, what did I say? I said the next culprit was going to be for the whack, and I meant it. Dressing gown and slippers outside the staff room now. As I make my way downstairs ahead of him, I realize the magnitude of what is about to happen. I threatened the whack, which at Cundall meant not the cane or a ruler or a slipper, but a plimsoll. I go into the staff room. Pipe smoke hangs in rooms in a quite different manner to cigarette smoke. Heavy layers of it are wafted into corrugated waves by the draught of my entrance. I close the door. In a cupboard under the master's pigeonholes, I find the official small black gym shoe, which I pick up and flex, bending it back on itself and letting it spring back. What have I done? If I fail to go through with the threatened beating, then such authority as I have will be undermined, and I will never be able to control the boys again. But how hard does one beat? Suppose I make him cry? Oh, good Lord. I pace up and down, slapping the sole of the gym shoe onto my palm, hard, then harder and harder until it stings fiercely. A timid knock at the door. I clear my throat. Enter! Phillips shuffles in. His face is set and serious. He is frightened. It is known that I have never administered the whack before, and I must suppose he cannot be certain that I will not be brutal. He seems to know the form better than I do, for he removes his dressing gown and hangs it on a hook at the back of the door in a manner that suggests he has done this many times before. I told you that whoever I caught mobbing about next was for the whack, didn't I, Phillips?
Yes, sir.
Why doesn't he beg for mercy? Then at least I might be in a position to relent. Instead, he stands there, fearful but maddeningly resolute, leaving me very few options. Right, well, let's get it over with, then. I have absolutely no idea how things should proceed at this point, but once again Phillips leads the way. He approaches the leather armchair in front of the fire and bends over its arm, presenting his posterior in the approved fashion. Oh, God. Oh, hell. I swing my arm upwards and bring the gym shoe down. It connects. There is a silence. There. Right. Well. Phillips twists his head round and shoots a look up at me. It is a look of complete shock. He is astounded.
Is that it, sir?
And let that be a lesson. When I say no messing around, I mean no messing around. Go on, then. Back to bed with you.
Sir.
Barely concealing his smirk, Phillips straightens, collects his dressing gown, and departs. The force with which the rubber sole of the gym shoe connected with his bottom would not have bruised a mosquito. If, instead of striking down, I had dropped the shoe onto him, it would have hurt more. It might as well have been a tissue as a plimsoll. It had not been a whack, but a feeble tap. I drop into the armchair, shaking all over. Never again. Never again would I threaten corporal punishment. And never again did I. The tall, mostly humorous, pipe-smoking oddity who taught all manner of subjects, refereed junior matches, and made himself useful to staff and boys as much as he could, enjoyed himself at Cundall, and Cundall seemed to like him, for when he said goodbye at the end of the summer term, the headmaster asked if he might be able to come back for the next term. But that's when I started Cambridge.
Michaelmas term at Cambridge doesn't begin till October. Our term starts a month earlier.
And so for the next 2 years I came back to Cundall and taught either side of the short Cambridge terms. In the summer I drove the tractor that pulled the gang mower around the cricket square, and I umpired cricket matches. In the winter months I took the boys for walks, and on rainy Sundays I compiled quizzes and competitions to keep them occupied. There was no question in my mind that teaching would be my career. It was my true calling, and one that sounded in my head as loud as any school bell. Whether I would teach in a place like Cundall, at university level, or somewhere in between, only my time at Cambridge would decide. If I had the intellectual heft to make it as an academic, then perhaps I would make scholarship my life. I imagined that Shakespearean studies would be my métier, and Tweed and Briar my constant accoutrements. It was a pleasant enough prospect. I was over that terrible sugar addiction and the madness and disruption it had caused. It had been replaced by a woody, tweedy, old-fashioned masculine dependency, which, so long as the supply was there, did not modify mood or behaviour, and which also served to remind me that I was now a mature, sober, rational adult. I made no allowance for love, sex, or the body, of course. I was fire and air. In other words, smoke. My other elements, like Cleopatra, I gave to baser life. 10 years later, in 1988, I met one of Britain's greatest smokers. He was at the time a premier drinker, too.
"I come," he told Rick Mayle, John Gordon Sinclair, John Sessions, Sarah Berger, Paul Mooney and me, as we gathered for the first rehearsal of his play, The Common Pursuit, "from the booze and fags generation." He slumped his shoulders down ruefully to emphasise that this was an ineluctable fact in whose remorseless face he was powerless. Simon Gray was then, I realise with a slight shudder, exactly the age I am as I write this now. He had, like his favourite actor Alan Bates, a full flop of black hair,
but his physique was less solid. Years of drinking had bulged his tummy into a gentle pot, while simultaneously wasting his lower half, so that he was spindle-shanked and all but arseless. I almost never saw him without a cigarette in one hand and a drinking receptacle in the other. In the mornings he gulped down champagne, which in his eyes barely counted as alcohol. From lunchtime onwards he sipped at endless coffee mugs or plastic cups of Glenfiddich whisky. It was the first time I had been at close quarters with an authentic alcoholic. Some of my generation drank more than was good for them and would go on to develop into the real thing, but for the moment youth was on their side. Unusually for the professional theatre, rehearsals for The Common Pursuit would begin after lunch. We all decided early on that this was because Simon, who was directing the production, was not able to function before that time. In fact, as I found out, it was because he spent the mornings at his desk. No matter how much he drank, he always seemed able to put in plenty of daily writing hours as a playwright and diarist. Just occasionally, I caught sight of him early in the morning before his first champagne. It was a ghastly sight. His face sagged, his eyes were dull, rheumy and bleared, his voice creaked huskily, and his whole being looked defeated and incapable of thought, action or purpose. One sip of an alcoholic drink, however, and he revived like a desert flower in the rain. He seemed to grow inches taller in front of you. A light and sparkle appeared in his eyes, his complexion smoothed and brightened, and his voice strengthened and cleared. Simon Gray, I decided when I first witnessed this frog-into-prince transformation, did not have a drinking problem. He had a drinking solution. Rick Mayle's nickname for him was Mr. Drinky. We adored him, and he appeared to adore us. "I know nothing of your generation," he would say. "I don't watch television, so I haven't seen The Young Ones or Blackadder or whatever the things you do are called. They told me to audition you, and so I did. You all seem absurdly young and confident, and I am assured that you will bring an audience into the theatre." That we seemed young to him, I can imagine, but that we gave the impression of confidence seemed extraordinary in any of us, except, of course, Rick Mayle. Rick was a force of nature who appeared charismatically invincible and fearlessly uninhibited from the moment he burst onto the comedy scene with his friend Ade Edmondson in the early 80s. I suppose that I too, as ever, emanated waves of looming self-confidence that I most certainly did not feel. The title of Simon's play came from a phrase coined and used as the title of a collection of essays by the critic and academic F.R. Leavis, who founded a whole school of English literature studies whose high seriousness, attention to detail, and earnest moral purpose were legendary. Simon Gray had been taught by Leavis himself at Cambridge and remained hugely influenced by him. For myself, I'd always thought Leavis a sanctimonious prick of only parochial significance. My own brand of undergraduate sanctimoniousness at work there, I now see, and certainly by the time I arrived at Cambridge, his influence had waned, he and his kind having been almost entirely eclipsed by the Parisian post-structuralists and their caravanserai of prolix and impenetrable evangels and dogmatically zealous acolytes. Stories of Frank Leavis and his harridan of a wife Queenie, snubbing, ostracizing, casting out and calumniating anyone who offended them, went the rounds, and those English academics at the university who had been in their orbit were callously dismissed by the elite as dead Leavisites. Leavis's intense, suspicious propensity to explode in wrath and to anathematize anyone who dared disagree with him I saw again in Harold Pinter, whose close but combustible friendship with Simon Gray and Simon's wife Beryl was an eternal source of delight to me and John Sessions in particular, as ardent connoisseurs of literary eccentricity. I remember once John and I were sitting in the back brasserie of the Groucho Club. Harold, his wife Lady Antonia, Beryl and Simon had a corner table. Suddenly Harold's booming voice burst out. "If you are capable of saying such a thing as that, Simon Gray, it is perfectly clear that there is no further basis for our friendship. We are leaving." We peeped round to see Harold rise with massive black polo-neck dignity, stub out a cigarette, toss down the remnants of a whisky, and sweep past us, growling all the while. That massive dignity was a little punctured by his realization that the faithful Pakenham hound was not at his heels. He turned and barked across the room.
Antonia!
Lady Magnesia Fridge Freezer, as Richard Ingrams liked to call her, jerked herself awake. Her defence against the madness of Harold's tantrums was always simply to fall asleep. She could do this in the middle of a meal or sentence, a kind of traumatic simplegia, a condition known only to cats in P.G. Woodhouse, but which I think refers to what we would now call narcolepsy, and softly gathered up her coat. By this time, the whole back brasserie was watching the scene unfold and greatly enjoying the embarrassed lacunae, charged glances, and menacing exchanges that one associates with the authentically pintoresque. Antonia smiled seraphically at the Greys and went to join her husband. As she passed our table, she stopped and gathered the loose wool at the shoulder of my pullover.
"Oh, what a lovely jumper,"
she sighed, fingering it for a second.
"Antonia!"
And she drifted away. I can almost bring myself to believe that the room burst into applause, but I think that would be an instance of the wish being father of the thought. I raise the issue of Leavis because the moral seriousness he inculcated into the study of letters left its mark on Simon Gray in strange ways. I remember an evening in the bar of the Watford Palace Theatre. We had performed the play for about a week prior to coming into the West End. That night's performance was a great success, and afterwards Simon dished out the few director's notes he had scribbled on tickets and taxi receipts while standing at the back of the theatre sipping Glenfiddich. The mood amongst us was good. He sighed something about how young we all were.
"Actually," said John Gordon Sinclair, "you remember when I auditioned and you asked me how old I was?"
"Yes," said Simon. "What of it?"
"Well, I said I was 28, but actually I'm only 25.
"What? What? Why?"
"Well, I knew that you'd cast Stephen and Rick and Johnny. They were like 29 and 30 and 32 or whatever, and I didn't want you to think I was too young."
"You lied?"
Simon stared at him aghast.
"Yes, well..." Gordy had clearly imagined that Simon would be amused. It was all over now. He was safely cast in the play. We could all share in the charm of his anxiety to be cast, and the little white lie he told to make it more likely. If anything, the story was a compliment to the play and his desire to be a part of it.
The smile vanished from Gordy's face as he realized that Simon was far from amused.
"You lied!"
A characteristic slump and a grimace of pain and despair swept over Simon.
"You lied!"
Poor Gordy was bright red now and wishing he was dead.
"Well, I thought, but to lie!"
Fond of Simon as I was, I thought this was a strange reaction. To disapprove of lying is one thing, but to disapprove of so benign and amiable a lie and so relentlessly to bear down on its perpetrator struck me as being bullying, priggish, mean, and grotesquely out of proportion. We all tried in our own way to defuse the moment, but Gordy felt rotten for the rest of the week, convinced that Simon was going to sack him, or at the very least hate him forever, and I was left wondering whether the malignant influence behind it all was whiskey or Leavis. The play we were there to put on chronicled the life of a group of friends who collaborate as students on the founding of a literary magazine called The Common Pursuit. Over the course of the play's action, hard, real life with its loves, infidelities, compromises and betrayals scuffs away the gloss and sheen of the group's noble ambitions and high Leavisite ideals. John Sessions took the leading part of Stuart, the magazine's editor, opposite Sarah Berger, who played his girlfriend Marigold. Paul Mooney was Martin, the best friend endowed with enough private means to keep the magazine going, and John Gordon Sinclair played Peter, a likeable serial philanderer, endlessly snared in a tangle of lies and evasions as he tries to run his chaotic seraglio of mistresses. My role was that of a broodingly intelligent, sexually constrained, waspish and socially awkward philosophy don called Humphrey Taylor, who ends up being murdered by a piece of rough trade a la James Pope Hennessy and perhaps Richard Lancelin Green. Rick took the part of Nick Finchling, a brilliant slapdash and entertaining historian who trades his academic promise for an easy career in the media. Nick is a heavy smoker, and towards the end of the play he develops emphysema. At one point, my character Humphrey upbraids him as he watches him light up and dissolve for the umpteenth time into a terrible coughing fit. "You should give up."
"Why?"
For one thing, you'll live longer.
Oh, you don't live longer. It just seems longer.
That was Mr. Drinky's view of his addictions, and now it was mine too. The previous year I had told everyone that I was going to give up smoking on the 24th of August, my 30th birthday. I managed 10 nicotine-free days at my house in Norfolk before a group of heavy-smoking friends arrived to stay, their presence soon bending and then snapping my puny will. I would not try again for almost 20 years. Instead, I adopted Simon Gray's guilt-free acceptance of the addiction. No, it was more than guilt-free acceptance. Cigarettes were proud banners to be flown. Objections to smoking in Simon's eyes were contemptible and bourgeois. He was always getting in terrible rows for lighting up in minicabs and those parts of theatres and public spaces which even back then were given over to non-smokers. The diaries he wrote and published throughout the 80s, 90s and into the noughties reveal a baleful champion of tobacco barging belligerently through an increasingly intolerant and hostile world. The titles of his final journals make this explicit. The Smoking Diaries, Volume 1, The Smoking Diaries 2, The Year of the Jouncer, and The Last Cigarette, Smoking Diaries 3. Of course, the body can take chronic assault from alcohol and tobacco for just so long. The time came for him to give up first one and then the other. I am in a quiet, residential Notting Hill street in 2006, filming for a documentary on manic depression. The director, Ross Wilson, positions the camera at one end of a long, straight pavement. I walk to the other end, turn round, and wait for his cue. All I have to do is walk towards the camera. No acting or speech required. It is one of dozens and dozens of such shots that are filmed all the time in documentaries, something to fill the screen for a voiced piece of commentary to be laid on later. And so I decided that a visit to the Royal College of Psychiatry might prove useful. That sort of thing. Ross waves for action, and I start the walk. From out of one of the houses shuffles an old man in a dressing gown, blocking the shot. I stop and return to my mark. This is always happening when we film in the street, and we're very used to it. Well, not old men in dressing gowns particularly, so much as members of the public, or civilians, as some people in the film and TV business call them, or, wince-inducingly these days, muggles. TV documentary is not major movie-making, where you have policemen and assistant directors to help marshal the citizenry. In such situations, we wait patiently and grin inanely. The man in the dressing gown slowly and painfully approaches, and I see that it is Simon Gray. His hair is almost white, and his face is sunken in. He looks dreadfully ill and much older than his 70 years. Hello, Simon.
Oh, hello.
We have only spoken to each other once since the terrible trauma of 1995, in which I had walked out of his play Cellmates and fled to Europe. As it happens, the documentary I am filming this very day seeks to find out, amongst other things, what had propelled me to that flight.
"So, what are you doing?" Simon asks.
"Oh, filming." I indicate the camera behind him. I think it wise not to mention that the events of 1995 are central to the film. He slowly turns, looks at it, and then comes round again to me.
"Ah, well, there we are, aren't we? A comedy of some kind, I suppose. Well, then."
Never has comedy been made to sound so low, vulgar, and pitiful. Simon had never forgiven me for leaving Cellmates. Initial worry and concern for my well-being at the moment of my leaving had rapidly been replaced by resentment, fury and contempt, all of which is very understandable. The show should have gone on. I see him just once more. It is July 2008, and I am in a box at Lord's Cricket Ground, watching Peterson and Bell put on nearly 300 runs for the fourth wicket against South Africa. The next-door box is filled with distinguished playwrights. Tom Stoppard, Ronald Harwood, David Hare, Harold Pinter, and, sitting quietly in a corner, Simon Gray. Playwrights and cricket have always gone together. Samuel Beckett remains, I believe I'm right in saying, the only Nobel laureate to have had an entry in the cricketer's almanac Wisden. At tea, the nubiferously chain-smoking pair of Tom Stoppard and Ronnie Harwood visit our rather show-busy box. David Frost is the host, and he wonders aloud if there might be a collective noun for a group of playwrights. Stoppard suggests the word snarl. The particular snarl of playwrights assembled next door has collected a pair of Oscars, a dozen BAFTAs and Olivier Awards, a CH, three CBEs, two knighthoods, and a Nobel Prize for Literature. I'm happy talking to Stoppard and Harwood, both of whom are as engaging, charming and friendly as Pinter and Gray are obstreperous, cantankerous and unstable. Pinter's capacity for explosive hostility and liverish offence at the tiniest imagined slight is legendary, and while he has never displayed any animosity towards me, I have always been very wary of speaking to him for more than a few minutes at a time, just in case. At the close of play, I make my way out of the box and walk straight in to Simon, whom I have not seen since that afternoon in Notting Hill. "Hello, Simon," I say. "Gosh, you look well." Which, compared to 2 years ago, he does. "Do I?" he says. "Well, that's terminal cancer for you. As a matter of fact, I'm dying. That was my last cricket match. Well, there we are. Goodbye." He died 3 weeks later. Whether the prostate cancer that killed him was in any way related to his smoking, I have no idea. I suspect that his alcoholism and 65 a day were not the cause of his death. At any rate, Simon Gray did die, and was justly mourned as one of the most individual, intelligent, and comically desperate voices of his time. I was not invited to the funeral. Rewind to 2006. I had decided, I'm not quite sure why, that it was time for me to stop smoking. Actually, I think I do know why. I had managed finally to give up the big thing, the thing we will turn to at some other time, and it annoyed me that I found it so hard to do the same with cigarettes. If I could abandon the systematic and heavy use of a Class A forbidden substance, surely I could fight off nicotine addiction with the merest snap of the fingers. On the shelf by my desk in my London house, there stood a strange object. Designed and built by the Dunhill Company, it seemed to be an old-fashioned BBC radio microphone. Disassemble and reassemble it in the manner of Scaramanga and his golden gun, however, and it became a pipe. This fine trophy had been presented to me a few years previously when I was named Pipe Smoker of the Year. On account of this, I now felt a slight twinge of guilt at the thought of quitting. I picked the award up and, like a child with a transformer toy, twisted, snapped, prized and pushed it into its alternative shape. It so fell out that my installation in 2003 was to be the last of these funny little Pipe Smoker of the Year ceremonies. The award was ruled by the health authorities to be a form of tobacco advertising by the back door, and from that year on was mercilessly proscribed. In its heyday, it had celebrated the great icons of the age, most of them a touch suburban and cardigany, perhaps, but from Harold Wilson to Eric Morecambe, by way of Tony Benn and Fred Truman, they had represented something rather splendid that has since gone out of British life. Neither smart, nor sophisticated, nor stylish, they were the kind of people you picture devoting their Sundays either to grappling with the garden hose and waxing the Wolseley, or to brisk fell-walking, a canvas haversack on their backs and long woolly socks up to their knees. Dunhill and the event's organisers went to great trouble to make me my special pipe, mix me my own blend of tobacco, and embrace me as one of their own. Now there I was, just 3 years later, planning to leave the fold. It seemed like a betrayal. As a matter of fact, I rarely smoked a pipe in public anyway. For the most part, I was a Marlborough man. Not full-on Marlborough Reds, nor anemic Marlborough Lights, but Mummy Bear Marlborough Mediums, for the compromiser in life. Middle-aged, middle-brow, middle-class, middle-rank, middle-tar. That's me. I reserved the old briar pipes for winter months and lonely hours at the writing desk. Although there had been just one recent occasion when I did go out into the world with a pipe. I was being profiled in the Independent newspaper in the summer of 2003. I cannot remember the purpose. Perhaps it was to coincide with the first series of the television programme QI. For no good reason, I turned up at the appointed place with a pipe in my pocket.
At some stage I must have run out of cigarettes and started in on it. A week later, to accompany the interview, there appeared a picture of me on the cover of the newspaper with the pipe jutting out of my face at an angle, a thick cloud of smoke artfully half-concealing my smug features. Sadly, my features know no other way of arranging themselves except smugly. Why had I taken the pipe along, and why had I smoked it in the presence of a photographer? Looking back, I now wonder if at some entirely subconscious level I had recognised that a pipe would suit the rather professorial side to my character that QI emphasised, and maybe that is why I had pocketed it when setting out to meet the journalist. What is interesting, or at least revealing, about the nature of 21st century celebrity is that it was only a few days after the publication of that interview that a letter arrived from the British Pipe Smokers' Council advising me that I had been elected that year's Pipe Smoker of the Year. This charming absurdity came so hard on the heels of the article that it was bound to give me the feeling that if it had chanced to be a bonobo who had been featured on the front page of The Independent smoking a pipe that week, then the accolade would surely have gone to it. Desperate is, I suppose, the word to describe the worshipful company of pipe smokers and tobacco blenders, and given the forthcoming demise of the award, perhaps their desperation had good cause. Now, there I sat, 3 years later, fiddling with my prize pipe and contemplating a betrayal of the smoking cause. Betrayal and cause are perhaps hysterical and self-important words to use, but smoking to me was a cause. It had always symbolised in my mind something enormous. I've mentioned Sherlock Holmes, but the fact is that almost all my heroes were not just figures who happened to smoke, but more than that, active, proud and positive smokers. They didn't just smoke in the world, they smoked at the world. Oscar Wilde was one of the pioneers of the cigarette. When he met Victor Hugo, the cher maître's major obsession was as much with Wilde's abundant supply of fresh, high-quality cigarettes as with his equally abundant supply of fresh, high-quality epigrams. Wilde's first episode of real notoriety came when he took to the stage to make his bow after the triumphant first night of Lady Windermere's Fan, with a cigarette between his fingers, a casual detail that enraged many present and was considered worthy enough to mention in just about every press report and in the letters and diaries of those who had been present. "A cigarette is the perfect type of a perfect pleasure," says Lord Henry Wotton in The Picture of Dorian Gray. "It is exquisite, and it leaves one unsatisfied." It took me a long time, as with so many of Wilde's remarks, to understand that this was actually much more profound an insight than it at first glance appeared. The point is that a pleasure which leaves you satisfied stops being a pleasure the moment it has been enjoyed. You are now sated. There is nothing more to be got from it. Sex and food are pleasures of this kind. What follows? A touch of afterglow, if you are that sort of person, but mostly guilt, flatulence and self-disgust. You don't want any more of that kind of pleasure for some time to come. As for behaviour modifiers like alcohol and narcotics, one may want more and more, but they alter mood and manner, and the crash and the hangover that come after can be deeply unpleasant and lowering to the spirits. But a cigarette? A cigarette delivers the keen joy, the hug of gratification, and then nothing more than the desire to experience it all over again, and so on. No moment of feeling engorged, full, unworthy and sick, nor hangover or mood crash. A cigarette is perfect because, like a highly evolved virus, it attaches itself to the brain of the user such that its only purpose is to induce them to have another. There is a reward for that in the form of pleasure, but the reward is too short-lived to be called satisfaction. I had then Holmes and Wilde on my side. I had Woodhouse and Churchill, Bogart and Bette Davis, Noel Coward and Tom Stoppard, Simon Gray and Harold Pinter. And ranged against us? Bourgeois nose-wrinklers, sour health-mongers, Hitler, Goebbels and Bernard Shaw, cranks, Puritans and interfering prigs. Smoking was a banner of bohemianism, a sign of the rejection of middle-class prudery and respectability, and I was a whale on that, despite being in my heart of hearts as middle-class, unadventurous and respectable as anyone I knew. One has, after all, no one to convince in these matters but oneself.
If I was to ally myself with outsiders, artists, radicals and revolutionaries, then it was natural that I would smoke and smoke proudly. I know. Pathetic, isn't it? I've said nothing of death here, nothing of the ravages to the complexion, throat, heart and lungs that cigarettes wreak. What Oscar did not know is that the most superb quality of all possessed by these beguiling little cylinders of joy is the gradualness of their toxicity, the imperceptibly nuanced encroachments of their poison. Their very benignity after the clammy dizziness, reeling and nausea induced in virgin smokers to which I have already alluded, the excruciating slowness and delicacy with which they set about their business of killing, the irresistibly tempting credit period they offer that promises so seemingly unbridgeable a distance between present pleasure and future payment. Such slow, unremitting and diabolical subtlety delivers what a true sadist and connoisseur of pain would surely consider the highest pitch of the exquisite. I had been a most vocal apologist for smoking and a noisily belligerent enemy of the anti-smoking lobby, but as I sat toying with the Dunhill microphone pipe that day, I realized that I had changed. Inasmuch as experiences are rarely to be regretted, there was something pleasing to my mind now in considering life as a non-smoker. I had enjoyed well over 30 years of tobacco use, and now I was to see what life would be like without it. I was almost looking forward to testing myself. So long as I pledged never, ever to be intolerant of those fellow smokers I left behind. Fight fire with fire, fight drugs with drugs. I had heard about a pill called Zyban, a proprietary name for amphibutamone, better known in America as Wellbutrin, one of the most prescribed antidepressants in the world. I had read somewhere that it also works as a smoking cessation aid in almost 30% of cases. I called up my doctor's secretary and made an appointment. He wrote out a prescription for a 3-week course. In the same way that these pills, in order to counter depression, acted on the brain's own store of mood elevators, noradrenaline and dopamine and so on, so they acted, it was claimed, to calm, inhibit and allay the anxieties and horrors of nicotine withdrawal. The unusual and appealing thing was that you were told to take the pill and carry on smoking. For some reason, the craving would leave you if you were one of the 27% on whom the treatment worked. And you know what? It turned out that I was. It was a miracle. I just found myself stopping and not minding. I fly to America for the first time in my life, happy to spend 12.5 hours on an aeroplane without being reduced to the indignity of nicotine replacement patches, gums and inhalers, sometimes, in the bad old days, all three at once. On the 4th Thursday of November, which is Thanksgiving Day in the United States, I have a meeting with the filmmaker Peter Jackson, for whom I am to write a screenplay based on the great raid on the German dams of the Ruhr in 1943. A masterpiece of British cinema had already been made on the Dam Busters story, of course, but we hope to be able to tell it again, incorporating details that in 1954 were too sensitive or secret to reveal. I arrive at the Beverly Hills Hotel bungalow that Peter has taken for the duration of his stay, and we talk over the details. Fran, Peter's wife, is present, as well as other members of their production company, Wingnut. Thanksgiving Day is a perfect time to have an uninterrupted meeting if, like us, you are not American. When the conference is over, an assistant loads into the boot of my rental car an enormous box of research materials that Wingnut has assembled for me. Every imaginable archival resource on the subject of the Dam Busters raid, in text, video, sound or photographic form, has been gathered together for my convenience. There is even a facsimile of R.C. Sheriff's screenplay of the 1954 Michael Anderson film. I drive along Sunset Boulevard, into West Hollywood, and towards the Chateau Marmont, the hotel where I have taken an apartment-like set of rooms for the month or so I have to deliver the screenplay. I spend a happy evening going through the documents and planning the next day's writing. How pleasant it all is! How lucky I am! What can go wrong? There is something of a commotion next door, and I look out into the corridor to see the actress Lindsay Lohan being stretchered away. It seems that her partying has caught up with her. The Chateau Marmont will always be best known, I fear, for being the scene of John Belushi's final fatal speedball. It is still a favourite haunt of Hollywood's more raffish party element, and Lindsay Lohan's unfortunate overdose, while not fatal, excites much attention. But these are things that do not need to worry me. The next day I am up early for a swim in the pool and raring to make a start on the script. I cook myself an omelette and brew up an enormous pot of coffee. The sweets in the chateau come with splendid kitchens. And settle down at my desk, photographs of Guy Gibson, Barnes Wallace and a Lancaster bomber blue-tacked up on the wall to inspire me. What could be more agreeable? But there is a problem. A terrible problem. I cannot write. My fingers go to the keyboard and I force them to type out Fade In, Interior, The Air Ministry, Evening, 1940. And that is as far as I can get. Ridiculous. I stand up and walk about the room. This can be no more than initial nerves. It is a potentially big project. The original film is one of my favourites. I am anxious about my right to tinker with this magnificent story. Sit down again and get on with it, Stephen. But it is more than that. As I stare at the screen, I feel that there is a void inside me, a dark space. What can it be, this sucking black hole that is somewhere between hunger, fear, dread, and pain? I shake my head and then my whole body, like a dog emerging from a bath. It will pass. I leave the room and descend in the elevator, listening to a couple swapping gossip on the subject of Lindsay Lohan's dramatic departure from the hotel the night before. I pace around the pool. Jerry Stiller, comedian and father of the actor Ben, is doing a few slow lengths. "Hiya, kid," he calls out. I do love, at the age of 49, to be called kid. After 10 or 20 circuits, I return to the room and sit once more before the screen. The black hole is still there. This is all terribly, terribly wrong. What can it be? What can it be? Am I ill? And then, with a bolt of certainty that almost knocks me from my chair, I realise what it is. I need a cigarette. I cannot write without a cigarette. It can't be true, surely. For the next 3 hours, I try everything I can to get the writing juices going, but by midday I realise that it is useless. Either I do not deliver the screenplay, or I smoke. I lift the telephone receiver. "Hello, it's Stephen here. Could you send up a carton of Marlborough, please?" "Yes, a whole carton. 10 packs. Thanks. Bye." Fast forward to April the following year, 2007. In July, the ban on smoking in public will come into force throughout the United Kingdom, and the month after that, I will be 50. Now, surely, it is time to give up once and for all. I've been hypnotised by Paul McKenna in an attempt to remove the hard wiring in my brain that associates writing with tobacco. I've been given a session at the Alan Carr Easy Way Clinic in London. Neither seems to have been much use, grateful as I am to each for offering help. But there is good news. A new drug has arrived. Farewell, Zyban. Hello, Champix. Pfizer's name for a new compound called varenicline, which is not an antidepressant but a nicotinic receptor partial agonist. What could be water? I have a course prescribed, and as with Zyban, I continue smoking as if nothing has happened. On about the 10th day, I notice that my ashtray is filled with absurdly long stubs. I've taken no more than one puff from each. By the end of the second week, I find myself taking cigarettes out of the pack, staring at them as if they are strangers, and replacing them. During this time, we are taping QI 2 or 3 times a week. When that finishes, I find that I am no longer buying packs of cigarettes. I have stopped smoking. I drive up to Norfolk and start filming for a new series of Kingdom. When this concludes, at the end of September, I fly to America to start work on a travel series. The real test comes later, however. In May 2008, I return to Britain from Hawaii, the last state to be visited for the documentary, and I need to sit down to write the book of the series. Only now will I see if I can, for the first time in my life, write something more than journalism, letters and occasional blogs, without consuming cigarette after cigarette as I type. It seems, when that day dawns, that my 35-year relationship with tobacco really is over. Writing these words as I have been, sitting in front of a computer and recalling the past, has the old urge returned? The experience has not opened up that black hole, but somewhere deep inside me, a trace memory twitches and thrashes like a dragon in a cave, sleeping a restless sleep. Have I betrayed a way of looking at the world? Have I turned my back on freedom, perversity, and outsiderism? Have I bourgeoisified and sold out? Most would think the question preposterous, but I do not. While the nicotine habit might rightly be characterized as dirty, dangerous, antisocial, ontologically pointless, and physically deleterious, and while those in its thrall might be regarded as reckless, foolish, self-indulgent, weak, and perverse, I still find myself drawn to smokers and irritated by those who nag and bully them. I was at a dinner party many years ago, sitting along from Tom Stoppard, who in those days smoked not just between courses but between mouthfuls. An American woman opposite watched in disbelief. "And you so intelligent!" "Excuse me," said Tom. "Knowing that those things are going to kill you," she said, "still you do it." "How differently I might behave," Tom said, "if immortality were an option." Substances seem insignificant compared to the big things in life, work, faith, knowledge, hope, fear, and love, but the appetites that drive us and our susceptibility, resistance, acceptance, and denial of substances define and reveal us at least as much as abstract expressions of belief or bald recitations of action and achievement. Maybe it's just me. Maybe other people have greater control over their appetites and less interest in them. I seem to have been driven by greedy need and needy greed all my life. 1. College to colleague. Cambridge. The winter of discontent, they called it. Strikes by lorry drivers, car workers, nurses, ambulance drivers, railwaymen, refuse collectors and gravediggers. I don't suppose I had ever been happier. After all the storm-tossed derangement of my teenage years, love, shame, theft, scandal, expulsion, attempted suicide, fraud, arrest, imprisonment and sentencing, I finally seemed to have found something close to equilibrium and fulfilment. Seemed. Smoking a pipe as a placid and confident figure of authority in a small prep school was one thing. Now here I was, at a huge university, starting all over again as a new boy, a fresher, a nobody. It is natural for people to despise the very idea of Oxford and Cambridge. Elitist, snobbish, hidebound, self-satisfied, arrogant and remote, the ancient universities, as they conceitedly style themselves, seem to embody the irrelevant, archaic, moribund and shameful past that Britain appears to be trying so hard to shed. And Oxbridge doesn't fool anybody with all that flannel about meritocracy and excellence. Are we supposed to be impressed by the silly names they give themselves? Fellows and stewards and deans and dons and proctors and prelectors. And as for the students or undergraduates, I beg their pompous pardons. Many people, but especially I think the young, see pretension and performance all around them. They will read attitudinizing and posturing in every gesture. If they were to walk down Trinity Street in Cambridge during term time, they would encounter youthful men and women that it would be very easy to characterise as self-conscious poseurs or play-acting pricks. Oh, they think they're so intellectual. Oh, they think they're so Brideshead Revisited. Oh, they think they're so la creme de la creme. Look at the way they bicycle along the cobbles with their arms folded, too cool to touch the handlebars. See how they walk along with their head in a book. See how they wrap their scarves around their necks with a flick, as if we're supposed to be impressed. Listen to their drawly public school voices, or worse, listen to their fake street accents.
Who do they think they are? Who do they bloody think they bloody are? Mow the fuckers down. Well, quite. But imagine for a moment that these wanky asshole poseurs are actually no more than young men and women with real lives and real feelings, just like anybody else, just like me and just like you. Imagine that they are quite as scared and unsure and hopeful and daft as you and me. Imagine that instant contempt and dislike really says more about the onlooker than about them. Then imagine something further. Imagine that just about every single student newly arrived at such a place as Cambridge went through exactly those same feelings of dislike, distrust and fear when looking at the easy and assured second and third years milling around them with all their relaxed confidence and their superior air of assurance and belonging. Imagine that they too had compensated for such feelings of nervous inadequacy by choosing to see through everyone else, by choosing to believe that those around them were pitiful poseurs. And imagine, finally, that without their noticing it, they somehow became absorbed and naturalized into the place to such an extent that now, to an outsider, they are the ones who look like arrogant tossers. Inside, you can take my word for it, they are still shrinking and shriveling like salted snails. I know, because I was one, just as you would have been too. It is true that I was a scholar. It is true that I was older than my first-year contemporaries. True also that I had more experience of the real world, whatever that might be supposed to be, than most. True as well that, unlike a surprising number of those arriving at university, I was very used to being away from home, having been sent to my first boarding school at the age of 7. True, too, that I had an apparently assured manner and a deep, resonant voice that made me sound as if I belonged to the place, quite as much as the wooden panels, shaved lawns and bowler-hatted porters. I concede all that, but it is very important that you understand, nonetheless, how very scared I was inside. I lived, you see, in quivering dread of being at any moment found out. No, it wasn't my status as a convicted criminal on probation that I wanted kept secret, nor my past history as thief, liar, forger, and jailbird. As far as I was concerned, those home truths were perfectly fit for broadcast, as was my sexuality, my ethnicity, or any other thing of that nature. No, the terror that gripped me during those first few weeks at Cambridge was all about my intellectual right to be there. My dread was that someone would approach and ask me, in front of a crowd of sneering onlookers, my opinion of Lermontov or superstring theory or the categorical imperatives of Kant. I would prevaricate and palter in my usual plausible way, but this being Cambridge, such stratagems would cut no ice with my remorseless and, in my imagination, gleefully malicious interrogator, who would stare at me with gimlet eyes and say in a harsh voice that crackled with mocking laughter, "Excuse me, but do you even know who Lermontov is? Or Rilke, or Hayek, or Saussure, or some other name, my ignorance of which would reveal the awful shallowness of my so-called education. At any moment it would come to light that my scholarship had been wrongly awarded, that there had been a muddle with examination papers, and some poor genius called Simon Frey or Stephen Pry had been cheated of their proper place. A relentless public inquisition would follow, in which I would be exposed as a dull-witted fake who had no business at a serious university. I could even picture the ceremony in which I was formally ejected from the college gates, slinking away to the sound of jeers and whistles. An institution like Cambridge was for other people, insiders, club members, the chosen, for them. You may think I am exaggerating, and perhaps I am, but by no more than 5%. All those thoughts truly did spin around in my head, and I really did fear that I had no right to be a Cambridge undergraduate, and that this truth would soon become obvious, along with academic and intellectual deficiencies that would reveal me to be entirely unworthy of matriculation. Part of the reason I felt all this is because I think I had a much higher doctrine of Cambridge than most undergraduates. I believed in it completely. I worshipped it. I had chosen it above Oxford or any other university because of... Oh, dear. There's no way of explaining this without sounding appallingly precious. My favourite 20th-century author in those days was E.M. Forster.
I hero-worshipped him and G.E. Moore and the Cambridge Apostles and their associated Bloomsbury satellites, Goldsworthy, Lowes Dickinson and Lytton Strachey, as well as the more illustrious planets in that system, Bertrand Russell, John Maynard Keynes and Ludwig Wittgenstein. I admired especially the cult of personal relations that Forster espoused, his view that friendship, warmth and honesty between people mattered more than any cause or any system of belief was for me a practical as well as a romantic ideal. "I hate the idea of causes," he wrote, "and if I had to choose between betraying my country and betraying my friend, I hope I should have the guts to betray my country." That claim, from an essay called What I Believe and published in his collection Two Cheers for Democracy, was taken by some to be all but treasonable. Given his connections to the group later known as the Cambridge Spies, it may be easy to see why such a credo still causes unease. He knew that, of course, for he went on to write, "Such a choice may scandalize the modern reader, and he may stretch out his patriotic hand to the telephone at once and ring up the police. It would not have shocked Dante, though. Dante places Brutus and Cassius in the lowest circle of hell because they had chosen to betray their friend Julius Caesar rather than their country, Rome. I know how insufferably awful I must appear when I tell you that I wanted to go to Cambridge because of the Bloomsbury Group and a parcel of puffy old bien-pensant writers and traitors, but there we are. It wasn't because of Peter Cook and John Cleese and the tradition of comedy, much as I admired that, nor was it because of Isaac Newton and Charles Darwin and the tradition of science, much as I admired that too. Cambridge's beauty as a university town had some influence, I suppose. I saw it before I ever saw Oxford, and it pierced my heart in a way that first love always does. But it really was, pretentious as it may sound, the intellectual and the ethical tradition that appealed to my puritanical and self-righteous soul. I had emerged from a monstrous youth, you must remember, and I suppose I felt I needed the holy fires of Cambridge to cleanse me. Cambridge produces martyrs, and Oxford burns them. I honestly cannot remember if that phrase is my own or whether I borrowed it from somebody else. I seem to be credited with it on the web, which proves nothing, of course. Anyway, it is true that Martyrs' Memorial in Oxford commemorates the burning of the three Cambridge divines, Hugh Latimer, Nicholas Ridley and Thomas Cranmer, in the city of Oxford. There's always been a sense that Oxford is a worldly, political and establishment institution, strong in humanities and history, and that Cambridge is more idealistic, iconoclastic and dissident, strong in mathematics and science. Certainly Oxford has provided Britain with 26 prime ministers, where Cambridge has managed only 15. It is indicative, too, that Oxford was the royalist headquarters during the English Civil War, while Cambridge was a parliamentarian stronghold. Indeed, Oliver Cromwell was a Cambridge alumnus and local to the area. Roundhead Cambridge, Cavalier Oxford. This pattern is repeated in theology. The Tractarian Oxford movement is high church to the point of being Romish, whereas Westcott House and Ridley Hall in Cambridge are low to the point of being evangelical. This same doctrinal distinction is even to be seen in comedy, mad as that may sound. Robert Hewison, an Oxonian, in his excellent book Monty Python, The Case Against, shows how the great Pythons were divided along Oxford and Cambridge lines. Those long, lean Cantabrigians, Virginia Woolf had noted 50 years earlier how Cambridge breeds them taller than Oxford, Cleese, Chapman and Idle, were all icy logic, sarcasm, cruelty and verbal play, while the Oxonians, Jones and Palin, were warmer, sillier and more surreal. "Let's have a dozen pantomime Princess Margarets running over a hill," Jones might suggest, to which Cleese would coldly riposte, "Why?" The creative tension between those two in particular, according to Hewison, formed the heart and soul of what Python was. You might see the same thing in the difference between Cambridge's Peter Cook and Jonathan Miller and Oxford's Dudley Moore and Alan Bennett. It is more than possible that you find the cuddly Dudley and the even cuddlier Alan Bennett and Michael Palin much more likeable than their tall, aloof and rather forbidding Cambridge counterparts. And perhaps this extends down to the later incarnations. Oxford's Rowan Atkinson and Richard Curtis are shorter and surely sweeter than the lofty and fractious Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie. There is tremendous romance in the Cavalier tradition and absolutely none in the Puritan. Oscar Wilde was an Oxford man, and a great part of me is deeply drawn to the Oxford of the aesthetic movement, Arnold's Scholar Gypsy and the Dreaming Spires. But the pull of Cambridge was always stronger. Forster's world marked me for her own at some point in my teenage years, and thenceforward it was Cambridge or nowhere. All of which goes some way towards explaining, perhaps, why I was so nervous about being found out. It was obvious to me that Cambridge, the mecca of the mind, would be filled with the most intellectually accomplished people in the world. Students of organic chemistry would be familiar with Horace and Heidegger, and classicists would know the laws of thermodynamics and the poetry of Empson. I was unworthy. I would have had to be epically delusional or truly medically paranoiac not to recognise such insecurities for what they were, a mixture of too idealistic a sense of what Cambridge was, allied to lashings of the worst kind of late adolescent solipsistic angst. I'd never fitted in at school, and now that I was come to a place almost expressly designed to suit me, suppose I turned out to be unable to fit in there, too. What did that say about me? It was too frightening to contemplate. But the first 2 weeks at a university are designed, which is to say they have evolved, to enforce the realisation amongst freshers that everybody is in the same punt and that everything will be fine. Besides which, after a few days, I'd met enough people and overheard enough conversations to realise that Cambridge was far from 5th-century Athens or 15th-century Florence. University life begins with the freshers' fair and all kinds of squashes, recruitment parties thrown by student clubs and societies. What with the comparatively healthy bank balance of a student in the first week of their academic year on the one hand, and that keen desire to be accepted and loved that flows from all the insecurities I've described on the other, it is likely that a fresher will join any number of extracurricular groups in their first week, from the established, the Footlights Club, Varsity Magazine and the Cambridge Union, to the weird, the Friends of the Illuminati, the Society of Tobacco Worshippers and the Beaglers Against Racism, all very silly and studenty and adorable. College and class. I suppose I'm going to have to stop off here and explain in the briefest and simplest of terms, if I can, the nature of collegiate life at Cambridge. Only Oxford has a comparable system, and there is no reason why anyone should understand how it works without having lived inside it. And, of course, no reason why anyone should care. Unless you are curious, in which case I love you, for curiosity about the world and all its corners is a beautiful thing, even if those corners are as uncool as the cloisters of Oxbridge. There are 25 Cambridge colleges, well, 31 in all, but two of those are for postgraduates, and the other four only accept mature students, each of which is a self-governing institution with its own history, income, property, and statutes. Trinity College is the largest, with 700 undergraduate students. It is also the wealthiest of all Oxbridge colleges, worth hundreds of millions and owning land everywhere. Others are poorer. In the 15th century, Queen's was a big supporter of King Richard III, whose boar's head device still flies from college banners, and it consequently suffered from confiscations and other financial penalties following that unfortunate monarch's defeat on Bosworth Field. Each college has a hall for dining, a chapel, a library, senior and junior combination rooms, common rooms at Oxford, and a porter's lodge. They are mostly medieval in fabric, and they are all medieval in structure and governance. They are entered by towered gateways and laid out in lawned and cobbled courts. At Oxford, these are called quads. You would not design an educational establishment from scratch along these peculiar lines, and indeed no one ever has. Yet for over 800 years the two collegiate universities have run without a break, and there has been no cause to change the fundamental principles that organise them, except through the slowest and most immeasurably gradual evolution. Whether Oxford and Cambridge can survive the envy, resentment, dislike and distrust of future generations, we can only guess. It is perfectly possible that someone will attach to them the hideous word inappropriate, or the hideous phrase not fit for purpose, and they will be turned into museums, heritage centres, or hotels. No one can stop them from being historic, however, and without vandalism, they cannot prevent them from being physically beautiful either. Those two qualities alone will ensure that, come what may, young people will want to go to them in sufficient numbers to risk their being considered elitist. An Oxbridge student is given a place not by the university but by his or her college, and it is there that they will live and take their instruction in the form of tutorials, which at Cambridge are called supervisions. The average number of undergraduate students at a college is about 300. When I arrived at Queen's in October 1978, there were five others reading English in my intake. Or was it six? I know one changed to theology and two others dropped out altogether. No matter. The university, as distinct from the colleges, runs the faculties, history, philosophy, law, classics, medicine, and so on, with their tenured readers, lecturers, and professors. In my time, Queen's had three English Literature Fellows, or Dons, who were also attached to the university's English faculty, although it is perfectly possible to be a fellow within a college, taking supervisions and teaching undergraduates, and yet be without a faculty post. Oh, Lord, this is so complicated and dull. I can almost hear your eyes glazing over. Look at it this way. You live and eat in your college and attend supervisions arranged by the Dons in your college for which you write essays. But you go to lectures and are ultimately examined by the university faculties, which are outside the college. There is no campus, but there are faculty buildings, lecture theatres, exam schools, and so on. Would it help if I said colleges are like Hogwarts houses, Hufflepuff and Ravenclaw, and so on? I have a horrible feeling it might. The Queen's College of St. Margaret and St. Bernard is one of the oldest in the university. It is also one of the prettiest, with a divine half-timbered cloister court, a charming medieval hall, all done over by Thomas Bodley and Byrne Jones at the height of the late Pre-Raphaelite period, and a famous wooden structure known as the Mathematical Bridge that spans the River Cam and connects the old part of the college with the new. When I arrived in 1978, Queen's was still an all-male institution. Girton, the first women's college, started taking men the following year, while the more advanced King's and Clare had been mixed for 6 years. But Queen's was carrying on in much the way it had for more than half a millennium. Incidentally, the apostrophe after the S is there on account of it being founded by two queens, Margaret of Anjou and Elizabeth Woodville. In Le Coeur's Memorials of Cambridge, which I'm sure you have read, but I will remind you anyway, the author, writing in about 1840, spells the name of the college as Queen's College with the apostrophe before the S, and appends a footnote. A custom has arisen latterly of writing the name Queen's College as being the foundation of two queens. This appears to us an unnecessary refinement. We have the authority of Erasmus against it, who always calls his college Collegium Reginae. Reginae is, of course, Latin for of the Queen in the singular. God, I sound like a guidebook, which is not surprising, as I'm quoting from the college website. Anyway, there you are. As the only English scholar in my year, I had been allocated a rather fabulous set of rooms overlooking the President's Gardens. That's another idiosyncratic Oxbridge nonsense, the titles given to heads of houses. Some are masters or mistresses, others are wardens, provosts, principals or rectors, and a few, as is the case with Queen's, are styled President. On the day I arrived, I stood at the bottom of my staircase and for 10 minutes I played with the exquisitely exciting proof that for the